Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, they happen to be the views this evening of Mr. William Grieg. And, of course, William, in the past, was the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and more recently, working with the Welch Foundation, has their blog site up there, writes extensively, does other radio programs. But we're always pleased to have William with us here on Friday evening, just a little early this time, so that our audience up there in the Spokane area will have a chance to hear from him. William, thank you so very much for being with us.
Dr. Sam, thank you so much for having me again.
All right, fine. Well, what is the burning issue that you'd like to talk about this evening?
I think one of the things that we're going to have to examine briefly is this new report from Seymour Hersh, who is a left-leaning but, I think, pretty reliable and remarkably astute investigative reporter, describing an alleged incident in which the Vice President, Dick Cheney, and a little clique of his like-minded neoconservatives and war hawks in the White House were trying to arrange some kind of a staged provocation with Iran to justify a war. They were trying to gin up some kind of a Remember the Maine type incident or some kind of Operation Northwoods, if you will, type of a scenario, a phony staged provocation as a pretext for war.
I think it's vitally important that our listeners understand that this is how you get your wars going. And certainly you can go back to the history of the wars we had. The sinking of the Maine back in 1898 was simply staged. I was blamed on the wicked Spanish. We had to go to war. We had to kill all the Spanish because they sunk the Maine. And then it ended up, the explosion was from inside the Maine, and of course the First World War, my goodness, those wicked Huns, they were cutting off the breasts of the Belgian women and cutting off the hands of little Belgian boys. It was all a lie. Second World War. What nobody understands is that American corporations were financing Adolf Hitler and their war machine both before and during the Second World War, but we never would want to talk about that. And, of course, they knew that the attack was coming on Pearl Harbor. I know because I have a copy of Secretary of War Simpson's diary, which, of course, he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, member of Skull and Bones. And Simpson, you know, wrote, you know, I think it was on the 25th of November, that he'd been to the White House. The president had told him the attack was coming the following Monday because it was a week late. But they knew exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah.
But, of course, they couldn't let the people there at Pearl Harbor know because they would want to put the ships to sea. They'd want to defend the people. And I share your concern. I think they're just looking for a reason to go to war with Iran, and if that happens, heaven help us.
Yeah, one of the abiding mysteries to me of our recent circumstances is the question, why haven't we yet seen some kind of a casus belli? And I think there are a couple of factors at work here, the first of which is that the people on this side of the equation, which is to say George W. Bush and the adults who are his handlers behind the scenes, most prominent among whom would be Dick Cheney, are looking for the right opportunity, and they have limited political capital right now. And I think that there are concerns here about getting the proper pieces in line, and so I don't think it's a matter of any type of abatement of their desire to see a war. I think it's a question of getting the logistics hammered out. And then the other thing is that there have been several staged provocations. We've had special forces elements in country, in Iran, for the last 2 or 3 years, according to a number of analysts. Some of them are military analysts employed by Fox News, so it's not as if we're dealing here exclusively with accounts coming from critics of the administration. Fox News is, for all intents and purposes, an appendage of the Bush regime.
Well, you hold that thought, William. We're going to be right back. But when you have your troops operating in a foreign country, that's an active war.
Yep.
And we've been at war with Iran for a long time. They just haven't told the American people. You go right ahead.
Yes, it's not just that we've had special forces on the ground in Iran, according to a number of intelligence analysts. The Bush administration has been funding this so-called People's Mujahideen, which is an Islamic Marxist group that has operated like a cult. And they have been operating in Iran doing all kinds of mischief, and they are the group that are considered to be the most reliable source of intelligence on the Iranian nuclear program, which is why we know that intelligence is complete bunk when they're talking about what's going on that account, because the Mujahideen al-Khalq is, I believe, the Farsi name for that organization, the so-called People's Mujahideen. They were part of the original coalition which brought Khomeini to power in 1978-1979. They were later purged by Khomeini as being too radical, which is an interesting position.
That's like calling the pot black, you know.
Exactly. You know, it's like the pot calling another pot, or calling the kettle pot. The thing is, the so-called People's Mujahideen are an organization that for all these decades have been lusting to get into power in Iran. The big question being, for many people over here, can you imagine something worse than the regime in Iran, which is admittedly a pretty terrible regime? Yes, there is another alternative that would be even worse, and that would be an outright communist regime of the sort that the Mujahideen, so-called People's Mujahideen, would represent. You're talking about different gravities of evil here. I certainly don't think that there are many governments worse than the government in Iran, but the MEK would be a worse alternative. But they've been running, the Bush administration has been running the Mujahideen, the so-called People's Mujahideen, within that country now for a number of years, in addition to activities with our own black operations, operation troops in Iran. So they've been conducting these affairs, and these are, of course, as you point out, by any rational reckoning, acts of war. But what Seymour Hersh points out is the following. He has said that there were a dozen ideas proffered about how to trigger a war. The one that interested me the most was, why don't we build, meaning the United States, in our shipyard, four or five boats that look like Iranian PT boats, put Navy SEALs on them with a lot of arms, and next time one of our boats goes into the Straits of Hormuz, start a shoot-up. It might cost some lives. It was rejected because you can't have Americans killing Americans. That's the kind of level stuff we're talking about, provocation, but that was rejected. That's really an interesting proposal and interesting little tidbit here revealed by Seymour Hersh, who's reporting on a number of Bush administration scandals has been stellar. The fact that you have, once again, this idea of staging a little incident as a pretext for war.
Well, that thought will be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Seymour Hersh, who actually I really enjoy, certainly is a leftist. But just because he's a leftist doesn't mean that what he says isn't true. And I've followed him for many years, and I've never seen him actually say anything that really wasn't true or he didn't believe was true. But certainly, William Grigg is talking about they're looking for a provocation for war. We saw what they did with Vietnam. They staged the attack, the Gulf of Tonkin incident. It did not occur. Everybody really admits today it did not occur, and 58,000 American boys died, and how many more will be crippled for life because of a staged incident? And now, again, apparently, according to Seymour Hersh, they're looking for a staged incident with Iran, where they could actually build some PT boats looking like the Iranian boats and put some of our SEALs on there and have them shoot at the Americans, and the Americans shoot back and kill them, or vice versa. But that apparently has been certainly rejected. But they are looking for an excuse to go to war. What sort of human beings would do that? The same sort of human beings that got us into the Vietnam War, a war we never went over there to fight to win. We just went over there to fight as a great distraction and, of course, bring about the Great Society programs. And while our boys were fighting over there in Vietnam and bleeding and suffering and dying, while they were, of course, bringing in the Great Society here at home, the effort to bring socialism to America. So we're over fighting socialism or communism in Southeast Asia, socialism and communism the same thing, just two sides of the same coin, as we're doing exactly the same thing. We're introducing an all-powerful central government and, of course, step by step, a police state in America. So William, what do you think is going to happen?
What I think is going to happen is that sometime between now and Inauguration Day, most likely, in my opinion, sometime after the election, we're going to have either a U.S. strike on Tehran or we're going to have an Israeli strike on Tehran, or what appears to be an Israeli strike that would actually be a joint operation with Washington. And I think that there have been efforts to precipitate some kind of a positive provocation by Iran, or as this report by Seymour Hersh points out, to confect one with the help of black ops operatives under the control of Washington, where you would have this little pageant, this wag-the-dog-style pageant there in the Straits, where you'd have Americans disguised as Iranians conducting a firefight in which there would be a possibility of loss of life, but probably not a whole lot. I think that Iran has not bitten at any of these provocations because while their ruling oligarchy is many contemptible things, you will not find stupid on that list. They know better than to start a war with the United States, although it would be more disastrous for us than it would be for them because it would be disastrous for them. Remember, this is a country that fought a 10-year-long war with Iraq in which the United States and the Soviet Union were supporting both sides of that war, keeping that war going for 10 years. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed in that war. It's impossible to find a household in Iran that didn't lose somebody, and often many members of their family, in that war. He had the spectacle of these martyrdom brigades, these young children being sent out with the supposed keys to heaven wrapped around their necks as the advanced division of a land army. They were sent out there to detonate landmines. And that sort of thing, of course, represents the sort of fanaticism that really can't be sustained. The Iranian regime, I want to reiterate, is an awful, awful government, but by and large the Iranian population is not anti-American, which is really quite remarkable in light of the fact that our relationship on a government-to-government level since 1953 has been perfectly horrid since the United States intervened to overthrow a mildly socialist, if the word mildly applies, a mildly socialist government in 1953 to install the Shah, and then in 1978 Washington intervened to remove the Shah and replace him with the Khomeiniist regime, which is just outright horrible. In spite of all this, there still is a really thick residue of pro-American sentiment among most Iranians, and so I think that there's a limit to what that government can do in terms of rallying the type of focused fanaticism that would lead to a war.
But I really think, and I've heard this scenario from people I really believe are very close to Israeli intelligence, and their claim is, of course, that you know Israel is going to attack Iran. Iran, of course, will respond by going to attack Israel, and of course, also attack the United States, because after all, there's no way that Israel could attack Iran without overflying, Iraq, which we control. So there's only one of two things. America would have to give Israel the permission to overfly Iraq, and that would be an act of war. And so Iran would respond, attack America. And at that point, the full fury of the United States would be, launched against Iran, and of course we'd just bomb them ferociously, and kill probably hundreds of thousands of Iranians for 3 or 4 days, and ask them to surrender. They would refuse, and then we'd just bomb them for another week or two. It is not simply by accident we have this, and anybody can check it out on the internet. If you Google in Iran 320,000 graves, they're already building the graves over there. They're digging the graves for 320,000 people, telling the Iranian people. That, of course, is for the enemy soldiers who are going to invade. Well, let me tell you, no enemy soldiers are going to invade. This is going to be an air war. I think that they know exactly what's happening. They just haven't told the Iranian people, and our government hasn't told us, that they've already decided that they're going to go to war with Iran.
Yeah, and I think that with respect to the issue of overflying Iraq, that's been simplified somewhat because, according to a couple of accounts I've read, there are already Israeli air elements that are forward positioned in Baghdad that would cut down the response time of the logistical challenge considerably if you could just launch from Baghdad as opposed to overflying Baghdad from Israel on the way to Iran. And I do think that we should point out here that this war that we are discussing here, this likely war that is likely to materialize very, very soon, would be disastrous for Israel as well. It would be disastrous for Iran. It would be terrible for the United States, particularly our troops who are stationed there in the Persian Gulf region. We confront the possibility of losing an entire army in the Persian Gulf, which would be a disaster for everybody, most particularly for the troops and their families.
But of course, then this would unite the American people behind our government. Mm-hmm. Because look, our boys have been killed. Therefore, we have to go over there, and we have to go to a war with Iran, and maybe a war with Pakistan. And we're sitting on the edge of a war with the Muslim world. I really mm-hmm. believe that. And of course, if you've read the Sybil Edmonds material, and I know you're well acquainted yeah. with it, we have been transferring nuclear technology and nuclear equipment to Pakistan for many years, so they yeah. could have nuclear weapons, so they could give them to the Muslim world. And people would say, why would any rational people do that? And, of course, the answer is we're not dealing with rational people.
Yeah. In order to understand the mindset of the people who were involved in this on the part of the government ruling in Washington, I always hearken back to my own ancestry among the Aztec Indians. There was this ritual called the Flower War that would involve the conquest of the tribes that surrounded the home city of the Aztec Empire that became Mexico City. In order to conquer a tribe, what the Aztecs would do was they would extend to the rulers of that tribe that is targeted for conquest the opportunity to stage a phony war. They would lead their troops onto the battlefield, and then they would withdraw, and then they would surrender their army with very little conquest, or forgive me, very little bloodshed. The conquest would be largely bloodless. And the rulers, who of course would commit this betrayal, would be able to watch the proceedings from behind a curtain of flowers. That's what was called a flower war. And they would be taken off and treated very well. They'd be able to live the rest of their lives in luxury and splendor, while the troops they had betrayed on the battlefield would be marched up the steps of Tenochtitlan's pyramid and sacrificed on the altars of Huitzilopochtli. And that's how they ended up conquering practically every tribe in the region, consolidating their power, and also how they kept up a steady supply of victims to the war god. That's how the Aztec rulers proceeded. They played on this idea that they had more in common with the rulers of the tribes they targeted for conquest than the rulers of either of those societies had with their subjects. And you can see that mentality at work here when Washington is considering scenarios that would involve the sacrifice of potentially tens or hundreds of thousands of American lives here in a war that really would serve nobody's interest but that of the power elite. And you can certainly see that kind of cynicism at work on the part of the government in Iran. I mean, any government that would hand the keys to paradise, the purported keys to paradise, to children, and then march those children out into minefields is obviously not a government that is ruling with the best interests of the people in mind, at heart. And so you're dealing here with the same kind of a ruling mindset, ruling worldview that you saw on the part of my Aztec ancestors in that respect. And that's pretty much a permanent and replicating facet of human nature, is that the type of people who end up running governments, by and large, look upon the populations they rule as the raw material of their grand schemes to remold the world. And we're certainly seeing that play out in the Persian Gulf right now. But I still find it worthwhile to comment on the astonishing cynicism of the people who are running the government that rules us out of Washington when they're talking here about the possibility of staging these little controlled engagements for the purpose of deceiving an easily distractible public into believing that we have a pretext for a war that would eventually, probably very quickly, destroy the world economy, drive the entire Western world, the world economy in total, as a matter of fact, into a depression. And people can't really see the connection here between what would happen on the battlefield and shutting down the Persian Gulf, completely cutting off, or almost completely cutting off, oil exports out of that region, and the collapse of the economy that would then ensue. They would probably be manipulated into believing that once again we are the victims of those terrible people over in Iran, and not forgetting for a second that the people ruling in Tehran are pretty terrible. We would actually be the victims of the people, those terrible people ruling us out of Washington.
And I really think it's so important. Certainly my May and my June, July newsletters simply quote a speech was given by Ron Paul talking about new conservatives. What are neoconservatives? Well, first of all, they're not conservatives. They're yeah. Trotskyites. They are basically have the mentality of communism. They embrace the philosophy of Machiavelli, who actually believed cruelty was perfectly permissible. That's why we're allowing the torture. That lying was an important part of the ruler, the prince. But the most important thing was war. You needed war, of course, to be able to control the people. If you haven't read my May and June, July newsletters, they should be posted on our website. If not, you can just give us a call. We'll be glad to send them to you. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're dealing with wicked people. And they're not in Tehran. They're in Washington.
Yeah,
go right ahead.
I think that really does encapsulate what we're talking about here, which is the infinite varieties and soundless depths of human wickedness. And for some reason that eludes me, most Americans are of the opinion that we enjoy some happy immunity to those aspects of fallen human nature that result in tyranny and warfare and bloodshed and tragedies of the sort that clotted the history pages of the 20th century with accounts of genocide and other forms of mass murder. Democide, the mass murder of people by their own governments, is probably the salient feature of 20th century political history. We seem to think that here in the United States, we are protected by the presumption of American exceptionalism from that type of a fate, when actually if we examine the actions and attributes and ambitions of the people ruling us out of Washington, it is a measure of God's grace, I believe, that we have not yet been driven into the abysm of outright despotism, and that we have not seen the type of fate visited upon our country that has been realized in unfortunate lands such as Germany and China and Soviet Russia. The fact that, once again, we have a government that on many occasions in our history, we mentioned, of course, the way that it capitalized on the sinking of the Maine, that, of course, was an accident that was colored later as an act of sabotage. It was colored at the time, rather, as an act of sabotage by the perfidious Spaniard. And, of course, the sinking of the Lusitania, and then the connivance of the FDR regime in bringing about the tragedy at Pearl Harbor, and then the Gulf of Tonkin episode, which was manufactured ex nihilo by the LBJ administration to get us into Vietnam. You see in the build-up to the first Persian Gulf War, the accounts of the babies being torn from incubators by these heartless invading Iraqi forces in Kuwait. That was a atrocity fable right out of the World War I playbook. You see in the build-up to the war in Iraq the second time in 2003, there was actually a proposal made by George W. Bush, probably, of course, in the capacity of a messenger boy, because I don't think his imagination is adequate to the task of creating this. There was a proposal made to Tony Blair that they set up a U-2 reconnaissance aircraft painted in UN colors to be shot down by the Iraqis as a pretext for war. When you take a look at the fact that our government has this long train of strategic deceptions and acts of manipulation to mislead and deceive our country into war, you've got to understand that's the type of a mindset that does reflect this type of unalloyed, unfiltered, undifferentiated evil. And so one of the things that I wish people would set aside is this idea that our ruling elite is somehow better than the ruling elite of other countries. We have better institutions. We have a constitution which is singular in human history because it is informed by this Christian understanding of fallen human nature. That's the one thing that really distinguishes us from any other society in history. It's not the fact that God made the United States his special favorite out of other nations. It's that the people who created this nation, the wise and far-sighted men who created the Union, the Republic, in the 18th century, were chastened by this understanding of their own iniquitous nature, their own fallen nature, the fact that they could not be trusted with power, that no man can be trusted with power, that there is no function of government that sanitizes those who wield political power from these frailties and failings of fallen human nature.
Here, I want you to hold that right there. We'll be back in just a moment with William Greig. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William was talking about America and really what an amazing country we are, because we're the only country in the world that recognizes that men are inherently evil and you can't trust them with power. And it was based upon that the founding fathers of this country created a government where the power of the government over the lives of the people was to be limited by the chains of the Constitution. Of course, these things have been largely forgotten. Nobody ever says, well, gee, if people really can't be trusted to govern themselves, that's why we need an all-powerful government. But if people can't be trusted to govern themselves, isn't the government made up of people? Wouldn't they be just as corrupt as the people they're ruling? And that, of course, is the age-old story. The age-old story has always been, the fact that the people wanted to be free and the ruling elite wanted to control them. It's exactly. happened time and again in the feudal societies. It is happening today. And until people understand what the neoconservative movement is, the fact that there really are covert organizations working behind the scenes, like the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Bohemian Grove, the Club of Rome, and we could go right on down the alphabet list of all these organizations, all intent upon a small group of people controlling the masses. But, of course, the most frightening thing is the people in control today are intent upon taking us into a war with Iran under one guise or another, and perhaps in a war with the Pakistan and the Muslim world, and probably a nuclear war as well, which really doesn't make sense unless you understand that we're dealing with people who have an entirely different worldview, because in my estimation, they worship a different god. But please go ahead, would
you? Yeah, you have to believe that they worship a different god, because fundamentally what they worship is their own supposed divine nature. It's the oldest and most persistent temptation in human history, which is the temptation toward idolatry. And I believe that all idolatry is ultimately self-worship, and it's something the book of Isaiah talks about when the Lord, through the prophet Isaiah, mocked the apostate Israelites for taking an axe to a tree and then fashioning out of the wood an idol and then prostrating yourself before this idol that is the work of your own hands and saying that it is your god. Ultimately, of course, you're worshiping yourself because you're the creator of the totem you are worshiping here. And I think that these people that we're talking about worship themselves as the executors of this supposedly limitless power and the possessors of this limitless virtue that endows them with the right and the responsibility of remolding the world closer to their heart's desire. But the fact that we have in our Constitution and in the legacy of our founding fathers this clear and clearly understood warning about fallen human nature and this recognition that those who wield political power are made out of exactly the same stuff as those who are governed by a given government, that's something that distinguishes the United States from the rest of the world. And once we do away with that distinction, really we are the same as the rest of the world with one terrific disadvantage, and that is that we are more naive. We don't have the antibodies against tyranny that people from a lot of these other societies have developed through sad experience. If you talk with a Russian, for instance, somebody who was never part of the nomenklatura, that is the Russian communist oligarchy, if you talk with somebody of that background about government, chances are he has a better understanding of the fundamental nature of government and the fundamental evil that emancipated government represents than your typical American does.
In fact, the thing is, so many of the people in this country from Russia or Eastern Europe, you know, recognize what's happening in America is just what's happening in their countries.
Exactly.
And they fear, you know, this wonderful country that they fled to for an opportunity to be free is going exactly the way that Eastern Europe and Russia and China did. I mean, one step at a time towards tyranny. And where is the outcry? Where is the cry saying, you can't do these things, they're unconstitutional? And even many times the Supreme Court has embraced these philosophies because there, too, they place people who have a different outlook on what's going on in the world. Go ahead.
I think you have a wonderful insight there, Dr. Stan, about the fact that a lot of the people who come from climes less hospitable to liberty have a more acute sense of what our country is losing than those who are born and raised under the gentle sunshine of our own heritage. And so often, the warning cries we hear about unconstitutional behavior from our government are delivered with accents and inflections of foreign lands. People who didn't have the luxury of simply inheriting this, but had somehow to earn this incredible privilege of living in this country and partaking of the blessings of our Constitution and that heritage. They are much more aware of what's going on, many of them, than native-born Americans who seem to believe that the American dream is purely materialistic rather than being the singular blessing of living in a country with a heritage of ordered liberty under God's law, with government reduced to the status of servant rather than elevated to the status of master.
And I think, of course, the frightening thing about Mr. Obama, he's wanting to change. He doesn't like our form of government. He wants to change. And I think what we need is to restore our Constitution to take government back from those wicked people who claimed our heritage. We'll be back in just a moment here with William Greig. Well, William, go right ahead there.
Well, you brought up, of course, something that I've been thinking about a lot and writing about and discussing with people, and that is the really interesting predicament we have here, where you have, on the one hand, in John McCain, somebody who is obviously and tragically disfigured by a desire to be waging war against everybody in perpetuity, and somebody who has, in his political career, never met a compromise of purported principle that he would not be willing to make. And on the other hand, you have in Mr. Obama somebody who has been the beneficiary of perhaps the most remarkable apotheosis of any presidential candidate we've ever seen. I don't think that there has ever been a case where somebody on the basis of so little has been so quickly elevated to presumed godhood as Mr. Obama.
I think we can thank the controlled media for that.
Sure.
I mean, they have built him up, they've created him, and they never will tell you, of course, any of the pretty bad things that he's been associated with, his long history of radicalism, association with communists and communist sympathizers, as a communist activist. This is never mentioned by the controlled media, but I will tell you, I subscribe to the communist publication, specifically Political Affairs, which is the theoretical journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, incidentally, the communist counterpart of Foreign Affairs, which is published by the CFR, but of course they're on the front cover of Political Affairs as a caricature of Barack Obama with the caption, "We're winning, we're winning."
Yeah. Well, the thing about Obama, apart from, you bring up the fact that he's got his roots squarely in this Chicago machine politics / Alinskyite social Marxist activist milieu, and that's what created Hillary Clinton, too. I mean, they come from exactly the same rootstock there. They're branches off the same Marxist taproot, if you will. But the thing about Obama is that his record is so slight, and the substance that he has offered in terms of what he intends to do once he has harnessed this inchoate demand for change are so nebulous that basically he's selling people the idea that he is somehow some kind of a moral test, and he's being presented in purely and frankly messianic terms to the public. Now, for the last 150 some odd years, actually since April 15th, 1865, with the death and beatification of Abraham Lincoln, there has been this effort to create out of every president this sense of institutionalized awe, where whoever it is who becomes president is draped in the finery, rhetorically and metaphorically speaking, of presumed deity.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course we've just been talking a little bit about Barack Hussein Obama. That's his name, Barack Hussein Obama. And of course, we need to understand that he is certainly is one of the most radical people ever to run for the presidency. He's certainly the most radical senator we have in the United States Senate. Only he's not there very much. He's all about campaigning. And of course, he's being given literally hundreds of millions of dollars to run for the presidency by people of like mind. But before we go on, William, I'd like you to get out your blog site and what people will find if they do go to your blog.
Appreciate that. The blog is entitled Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. And the easiest way to find it, actually, is to go by way of the homepage of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. The web address for The Right Source is www.rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's rightsourceonline.com. At the top of the first page of that website, there's a banner ad for my most recent book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. Liberty in Eclipse is available by clicking there. Click through the banner ad at the top of the website, The Right Source, or you can order it from Amazon.com. It's also available by way of Radio Liberty, and Liberty in Eclipse is about 300 pages long. And it's an attempt not only to expose and to document our descent into a garrison state, or if you care to describe it as such, a police state, but also to talk about the roots of how this happened and to give some ideas toward the end of the study as to what we can do by way of trying to pare back the existing garrison state and try to reinstitute some of the controls that we have to exercise on the government's coercive functions. We live, to be frank about it, under a embryonic but recognizable militarized, centralized homeland security state or police state rather than under a republic right now. We no longer really have a situation where our law enforcement bodies are under local control and accountable to the local population. There really are very few, if any, remaining constitutional checks that separate the law enforcement and military functions of our government. Those were supposed to be kept strictly separate. And law enforcement was to be almost entirely a state and local affair under the scheme of liberty and divided powers given to us by our founders. Now we have, instead of locally controlled police and sheriff's departments, we have local affiliates of a nationalized and militarized homeland security state, the purpose of which is not to protect our rights and to backstop the efforts of individual citizens to protect their liberty, but rather to ensure that we submit to the demands of our rulers. It's no longer to protect and serve, it is now to compel and to force to submit. That's a horrible, horrible state of affairs to live under. It's only going to get worse unless we do what we can to mobilize in a principled way the efforts of conscious and aware citizens to pare back once again the growth of this homeland security state.
I'd just like to point out, I don't think, though, that for 1 minute you support John McCain, certainly.
Of course not.
That's important
for Vizzo.
I think it's so important people understand that both people, both candidates, Democrat and Republican, controlled by the same people. Certainly, Henry Kissinger is back there backing John McCain. Mm-hmm. John McCain's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and surrounded by advisors from the CFR. Obama's surrounded by people from the CFR. He's not himself a member, but certainly he is one of their... They don't care which one wins. Whichever one wins, their candidate wins. When you understand this is the way that the game is always played, I think that they probably would prefer to have McCain in there, but they really don't care because they control and will control both the foreign and domestic policy of the new administration. Anybody doubts that needs to read the writings of Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, at least according to Samuel Huntington. Professor Carol Quigley was the leading historian of the last century, of the 20th century, at least the last half of the 20th century. And in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, pages 1247, 1248, he makes it very simple. We have to let the people go to the polls every 4 years to vote the scoundrels out. But nothing will change. The foreign and domestic policy will remain the same. Once you understand that, you can understand what's going on. And the fact that there are other candidates running, certainly we saw Ron Paul, he's dropped out pretty well at the present time, although he, you know, and they won't even allow him to speak there at the convention. But you have people like Chuck Baldwin, who's running on Ron Paul's, platform, and not a word from the controlled media, because we have freedom of the press in America, which means if you own the press, if you own the media, you have the freedom to censor anything you want to. And believe me, 5 or 6 major corporations control 90% to 95% of the major media outlets in America, and ultimately determine in large part what the American people think and believe. Go right ahead, William.
Well, you make the point about having freedom of the press if you own the press that is to be free, and that's one reason I have a blog. a blog, of course, is the best thing to having the cyber age equivalent of a printing press. And if you go to rightsourceonline.com, you scroll down about a third of the way down the page, you'll find my photograph. Next to my photograph, there's a hyperlink that will take you right to Pro Libertate, which is published between 3 and 5 times a week, depending on my schedule. I'll publish something new on there as my schedule permits. It'll usually be a 1,200 to 2,000 word essay. I don't write a blog in the typical conventional sense of writing a few paragraphs to reflect on what's going on briefly by way of ephemeral comments about the passing scene. I try to write a fully documented work of what I call investigative polemics. I'm an editorialist. I'm an opinion columnist. I don't hide my point of view. I try to document it. I try to authenticate it. validated the best I can. And, of course, hyperlinks are a wonderful way of doing that, as well as references I make when I'm quoting from a book that's not online. But the purpose of Pro Libertate is to examine current affairs from the perspective of somebody who is, quite frankly, obsessed with individual freedom. When you talk about the relationship between Obama and McCain, they're perfectly fungible. That's the luxury of this establishment that Carol Quigley talked about, is that they have a pretty deep bench when it comes to people who have already plighted their troth to the existing establishment, the people who are willing handmaidens of the power elite. And McCain has served them very well for a number of decades. He's a thoroughly compromised individual, compromised in ways that most people, are, even in politics, are not. And Mr. Obama is entirely a creation of the people who have created him. It's interesting to me that I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he actually changed his name to Barack when he was an adolescent, from something that was a more conventional Anglophile name, such as, I think it was Bruce or something to that effect, and he chose the name Barack as a token, I guess, of his emancipation or his radicalism or some other impulse that he's not deigned to define for our edification. But the thing is, I'm trying to figure out how it is that somebody of that background, who has a vita that is redolent of the reddest radicalism, and who has a name that is so exotic and off-putting in an age when we're told that we're at war with pretty much the entire Muslim world, how somebody of that sort, with a very thin resume of accomplishment, I mean a resume that's basically a single slice of onion skin paper, can suddenly find himself as the preferred candidate and the odds-on favorite to win the presidency, and that, I think, attests to the power of this controlled media you're talking about. Because it really doesn't seem like there was a marketplace, say, 2 or 3 years ago, for a red-dyed black candidate with a Muslim name and a dodgy background to be the successor to a purported conservative Christian from Texas. I don't think that the electorate is quite that flighty or whimsical. I think that there's something else at work, and that something else would be an effort to engineer some kind of public consensus and on behalf of what Obama supposedly represents, which is change. And it's not change in the terms of going into Washington, D.C., like Hercules, to clean the Aegean stables. I mean, that's the type of change Ron Paul was talking about, restoring our institutions, restoring our Constitution, tearing back government, as a matter of fact, doing away with most of it, because most of it is consummately unconstitutional. What Barack Obama is talking about is change, as in, invest all your hopes in me as your next short-term messiah, entitle me and endow me with the power of public consent, you know, the general will, to use the expression from the French Revolution, the Rousseauist notion of the general will being embodied in a single leader. Let us do away with checks and balances and do away with restraints on power, because they merely limit the good we can do once we have united behind some divinely consecrated leader. And let's make radical changes in terms of the concept of our government and the concepts that undergird our society and our republic. That's what Barack Obama represents. He's somebody who is, over the last 2 or 3 months, has made it very clear that in substantive terms, he's not terribly different from Bush or McCain. In the case of George W. Bush and what's happened over the last 8 years, they've basically eviscerated the Bill of Rights. They've done away with habeas corpus. They've instituted a wireless wiretapping, or forgive me, a constitution, a warrantless, unconstitutional wiretapping program that involves the frank abolition of the Fourth Amendment. There have been legislative votes on these matters over the last 2 or 3 months, and Barack Obama has come down solidly on the side of those trying to tear up our Constitution. That's the kind of change he represents. He doesn't represent the repudiation of these elements of what Bush did and what McCain supports. He represents their consummation.
In fact, I think it was so interesting when he was overseas recently, within the last 2 weeks, that looked at Afghanistan. His remark was, what we need is more troops to Afghanistan. Why do we want more troops in Afghanistan? Well, how are we going to win?
Yeah.
You can't win over there.
No.
I mean, you know, the British couldn't win there. The Russians couldn't win there. Why would we think that Barack Obama could win there? Or, you know, we ought to pull our troops out. We had no business going in the first place. The reason that they had the problems was because, of course, of the Taliban. And who financed the Taliban? Why, Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Our friends in Pakistan, our friends in Saudi Arabia, and the CIA. And we've got documentation, books written before the September 11th attack, talking about how the CIA was funding the Taliban. Yeah. And Al-Qaeda as well. So maybe what we ought to do is just pull out, because I don't see any sense in fighting an enemy that's being funded by the Pakistani intelligence, is being funded by the Pakistani government, that's being funded with my tax dollars. I resent that.
Sure.
And every boy who dies there dies needlessly. We went in because we wanted to get Osama bin Laden. We never tried to get Osama bin Laden. Because if we'd gotten Osama bin Laden, how could we have justified the war? And we have an article from the Washington Times going back to October of 2001 where a high-ranking official, I'll be glad to send copies of that article to anybody who wants to read it, a high official said, our policy is not to get Osama bin Laden first. Our policy is to get Osama bin Laden last. If we were to get Osama bin Laden, how would we justify this war?
Yeah.
That was October of 2001, and how many boys have died needlessly since then, and how many Afghan men and women and children have died. Because, after all, if we got Osama bin Laden, how could we justify the war? It's about time we brought our troops home, and I believe that Obama, if he's elected, will continue exactly the same course as McCain would, but, of course, we can't let the American people know that.
Yeah. The biggest difference, of course, is that it would become something of a civic heresy, if not a criminal offense, to speak of Barack Obama with anything other than chastened reverence, because he's frankly being anointed as the Messiah, which is why in my blog recently I've started to make snide remarks about his holiness and Saint Barack. He is untouchable in that respect. He's done nothing. He has said nothing of substance that differs in any way from John McCain or George W. Bush. But by virtue of the fact that he would be the first black president of the United States, he's politically unassailable. And the fact that he has a certain facile eloquence, or the presumption of eloquence, when he reads the speeches off a teleprompter, has really made him somewhat inviolate. The fact that, unlike the incumbent president, he can speak in complete sentences that make sense is quite beguiling to people. But there really is little, if any, visible substance to Barack Obama. His policy proposals, when they are not, once again, near carbon copies of those of Bush and McCain, have the substance of a boiled ghost. And he's not particularly glib or well-spoken when he is not reading a speech from a teleprompter. And a lot of his speeches have been, quite frankly, insipid. The one speech that he made a few months ago about race relations was an indigestible porridge of predigested cliches. The only thing I remember about that speech is that he kicked his grandmother to the curb by referring to her as more or less exemplary of white racism, which is the sort of thing I think that reflects very badly on what passes for his character. You don't throw your family to the wolves unless, of course, you are so consumed by political ambition that you're willing to do so as a temporary expedient. And so when I see Barack Obama, I see something that makes me nauseous reflexively, and that is a self-enraptured person who is auditioning for messiahhood. We had that type of a personage in Bill Clinton. We had that type of a personage in George W. Bush. I think the third time is going to be the opposite of a charm if we end up with Barack Obama being elected. But, of course, John McCain is no better of an alternative. And I find myself wondering, actually, if John McCain is going to go the distance as a Republican nominee, because there are health issues here, there are issues with his age. He doesn't really display to me the passion of somebody who's really interested in the office. He's running a campaign that is even less convincing than that of Robert Dole in 1996, and the Robert Dole presidential campaign was, quite frankly, the least convincing expedition of its sort since Wendell Willkie threw the 1940 election on behalf of FDR. Wendell Willkie being a lifelong Democrat who was probably never a formal convert to the Republican Party and also an asset of British intelligence, who was retained by FDR's regime and British intelligence specifically to throw that election in 1940. I mean, before the votes had all been tabulated, Willkie had received a position in FDR's government. I can't remember what his specific posting was, but before inaugural day in 1941, I believe it was still in March back then, Wendell Willkie and FDR, their little entente had become so well publicized that at a year-end newsreel that was shown for the White House press corps, there was a little cartoon of Wendell Willkie and FDR cuddling up in bed together. It was well known by these people that Willkie had thrown the election. And, of course, you've got the same type of a thing here where John McCain apparently is doing everything he can to make himself as unappetizing to the electorate as possible. And I don't know whether that's out of conscious design. I don't know if that's just his personality manifesting itself. I don't know if there's going to be some dramatic turnaround and McCain would suddenly emerge as the favorite. I really find that hard to believe. Although, tracking the polls, they seem to be within a margin of error of each other. But the fact is, as I look at this, I find myself wondering if maybe at the convention you might end up with another candidate, maybe a Mitt Romney or somebody of that sort. Or we might end up with a deadlock in the November election like we had in 2000, except a more intractable one. And then seeing how the Electoral College actually get into play. But the fact is, people who invest their hopes in the presidential candidate as a solution to our problems are looking in the wrong place, because presidential politics at the level of the general election tend to be almost completely controlled by the people that Carol Quigley talked about.
And they, as he said, you know,
filter out people who would be constitutionalists before they get to the general election.
And of course, we have to let the people go to the polls every 4 years so they can throw the rascals out, but nothing's going to change.
Yeah. Well, catharsis.
People, it's so important that you understand, ladies and gentlemen, they're lying to us. But we can take America back if there's enough people who are willing to join us in this epic struggle, this truly spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Our guest has been William Grieg. I hope you enjoy it. I know I always enjoy it. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up tonight's program. My goodness, this went by very rapidly.
Yeah, it really did. Once again, I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your program, Dr. Stan. It's a real blessing to me.
And well, of course, right now, we've got a much larger audience. We've got, of course, our 4 stations there in eastern Washington, as well as our network in the east. So I wanted to introduce you again to our audience there on the West Coast.
I really appreciate that. And for their benefit, once again, I would suggest that they go to rightsourceonline.com and look for the banner ad for my book and also for the link for my blog. If they want to go to my blog directly, it's very easy. Just Google Pro Libertate. It should be one of the first results you would get if you type that into Google. Or go to www.freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Blogspot is BLOGSPOT. That's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Dr. Stan, I wholeheartedly agree with you that this is a spiritual struggle before it's anything else. And when you talk about the collision of these religious views, we're dealing about something as simple as understanding the difference between the Tower of Babel and the cross on Calvary. The former, of course, is a representation of this age-old demonic desire to unify all of humanity under one supervisory elite from whom nothing would be withheld in terms of their ability to reorganize humanity as they see fit. And the other, the cross of Calvary, symbolizes freedom in the ultimate sense, that is to say salvation, freedom from our blood guilt as being sinners, but also the perfect law of liberty that Jesus Christ represents. And it was that view that informed the men who created these institutions of government that were supposed to govern our republic. Rebuilding those institutions will require that people make some sacrifices. And in the times that are coming, as this financial system collapses and as what's left of our Constitution is driven into the dirt, I think that there are going to be a lot of people driven to their knees. And I think that that is where our ultimate source of hope resides.
I think you're absolutely
right.
Get to
our knees and get up and fight.
And I really think you're absolutely right. I mean, the one thing that encourages me is the realization that we're moving into some very, very difficult times. And when people begin to lose all the material wealth that they have, when they lose the things that they put all their confidence in, when they get out of their comfort zone, they're going to be starting to ask for answers, and I just hope we have really tens of thousands of people out across America who've learned from your writings and from my programs and from the work of other people as well what this is really all about. And, of course, the only hope for America is that people begin to understand that freedom is not the ability to do what you want to. Freedom is the ability to do what you should do according to God's commandments. And, of course, what we need to do is fear God and keep His commandments. Our guest this evening has been William Grieg. God bless. We'll talk to you again next week, I hope.
God bless. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So much.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I do hope you enjoy our conversation with William Craig. And remember, we do talk through the breaks. And so if you would like to get the complete CD or tape of the program, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 or 1-5-HIV, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We do carry Whittem's book, Liberty and Eclipse. That's Liberty and Eclipse, an excellent book. We recommend it to you. And then, of course, we have so much material out here that will help you understand what's really going on. Of course, we have books on every subject. We actually have books on the AIDS epidemic, a great new book called AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief by Adon Scott. Does an excellent job. Genetic Roulette by Jeffrey Smith. That's Genetic Roulette. Goes into how they're poisoning us with genetically modified foods. The Europeans won't allow the genetically modified foods over there. And here you're not even allowed to know that you're being poisoned by eating them. People say they wouldn't poison us. And I would say, why not? I mean, certainly they're poisoning us with aluminum. They're spraying it into our atmosphere. They're actually putting it into the vaccines. We're telling everybody they have to get, oh, my goodness, you've got to get an influenza vaccine. They don't do any good. It's the children. Or to the pregnant women they give them to, or to the elderly, but they do a great deal of harm and are certainly interrelated with the incidence, growing incidence of Alzheimer's disease, that and the mercury that they're poisoning our people with. And then, of course, we certainly they're being poisoned with lead. If you actually have fluoridated water and in your area, they usually, chances are, using hydroflow salicylic acid. And there's one study done by Robert Masters, by Dr. Masters back at Dartmouth University, noted that if you have fluoridated hydroflow salicylic acid used to fluoridate your drinking water, and that's the majority of the drinking water in America, why, the incidence of lead in the blood. Now, remember, they're using hydroflow salicylic acid. It contains lead, it contains arsenic, it contains polonium-220. Yes, it contains fluoride as well, but of course, for some reason or other, the level of lead shoots up in the bloodstream, doubles in whites, four times in Hispanics, and six times in blacks, and of course, this creates raids and criminal activity. And Robin Masters back there at Dartmouth University, we have my interviews with him. He'd like to verify what we're saying. We also have the studies he quotes. And then, of course, where they're poisoning us with aspartame in our food. They're poisoning us certainly with depleted uranium, at least the boys who are overseas. They're certainly poisoning us with water fluoridation because the fluoride in itself is harmful. It's a deadly poison. What do you think is in rat poison? Why, it's if it isn't Coumadin, why, it's fluoride. And that's what they spread spray our vegetables and our fruits with, because it kills insects. It certainly does. If it's going to kill insects, well, then why are they putting it in our drinking water? Well, ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand there are people who have a different worldview. If you have not heard my talk on Nundair College Genocide or my talk on planned population reduction, you need to get that information. You need, of course, to get my talk on the hidden agenda, the story of water fluoridation, and the syllabus that goes with that is excellent. We have so much information. If you'd like a free catalog, give us a call. We'll send you one. 1-800-544-8927. Tell us if you want a printed catalog or a CD-ROM catalog. Very, very nicely done, but some people, of course, don't like CD-ROM catalog. So if you want a printed catalog, ask for it. Want a regular catalog, we'll get it for you. If you'd like our health food catalog, if you'd like our emergency supply food catalog, we've got all of these things. And we want you to begin preparing for the very, very difficult times that certainly do lie ahead. We want you to go to our webpage and where you can see our videos. You can see our special videos. It's called Other Videos. Just start looking at those links there and start watching the videos and listen to our programs. You get 4 hours live and 9 hours actually there on our satellite feed at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our website, about our newsletters, about our videos, and then that you'll pray for America, that you'll pray for revival, that you'll pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and we'll be back in just a moment for the second hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to at the present time. They're my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grant, who is going to be talking about vitamin D. Now, one of the biggest problems we have at the present time is we're told, oh, you don't want to get out in the sun. You don't want to get out in the sun. You're going to get skin cancer, melanoma, you're going to die. If you go out in the sun, use all sorts of sunscreen so that the sun's rays won't get to your skin. And yet, of course, sun is very important. Certainly, it produces vitamin D. And without vitamin D, why, we lay ourselves open to all sorts of problems. The government recommends very, very low-dose vitamin D if you're going to use supplements. Of course, they're really not necessary. And the tragedy is they are necessary. And I'm sure Mr. Grant is going to tell us a great deal of why these things are so, why vitamin D is so vitally important. And only recently has there been suddenly an awareness on the part of researchers and other people studying this and trying to get the information out. So if you're out there in the audience, you will understand that one of the big problems we have is vitamin D deficiency. Mr. Grant, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why don't you just go ahead, tell our listeners just a little bit about your background, and then why vitamin D is so important and why we shouldn't cover ourselves all up with sunscreen when we go out in the sun.
Okay, first a little about myself. I have a PhD in physics from the University of California, Berkeley. I was there during the tumultuous years of the 60s and got a very good education. And in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, I worked primarily with laser systems, developing laser systems and using them to study atmospheric constituents, ozone, aerosols, and things like that. I've always had a strong interest in environmental activities and topics. And in the early 90s, when I was in Virginia working with NASA, I did a Sierra Club project on the effects of acid rain and ozone on the eastern hardwood forest. And I've been able to identify some effects. But more importantly, I learned how to use the ecological approach in epidemiology. Now, what this means is that populations defined geographically are the entities. And one looks at disease outcomes for the population as a whole and looks at the risk factors for the population as a whole. And in 1996, I read that Japanese-American men in Hawaii had 2.5 times as much Alzheimer's disease prevalent as native Japanese. Now, I found that very interesting because at that time it was thought that genetics was the primary driver for the risk of Alzheimer's. And there was an atmospheric scientist and a physicist very naively charging into the health field. And what I hypothesized was that the dietary factors were the most important environmental risk factor for Alzheimer's, and that if I use the ecological approach with Alzheimer's prevalence by country and dietary factors by country, I could solve the riddle what caused Alzheimer's. So it charging off and very quickly found that it was total amount of energy in a diet, number of calories, as well as the amount of total fat, which were the big risk factors, whereas fish and cereals and grains reduced the risk. This got published in June 1997. I made Dan Rather and CNN, and it was like hitting a home run the first time at bat in the major league. So then I went off, I did sugar and heart disease, found that women below the age of 65 clog their arteries from eating too much sugar, whereas older women and men of all ages clog their arteries eating animal fat.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
With William Grant. All right, fine. Well, of course, our guest this evening, Dr. William Grant, we're talking certainly about the relationship of diet to health issues. So pick up the story there.
Okay, so in the year 2000, I saw the map, what is it called, the Atlas of Cancer Mortality Rates for the United States. So they have about 30 types of cancer, and they showed the mortality rates for 25 and 30-year periods by county and by state economic area and by state. And what I saw was that in the southwest United States, the rates for most of the common cancers like breast, colon, prostate, and ovarian were very low compared to the rates in the northeast. And you know, still just looking at dietary factors, I thought that, well, if I get the dietary factors for the various parts of the country, I can explain why cancer varies so much from one state to another. Well, I quickly was disabused of that idea. Realize that everybody eats at McDonald's or shops at Safeway or the equivalent, and so we're eating the same thing. It would have taken the Northern European diet in the Northeast and the Pan-Southeast Asian diet in the Southwest to explain it based on dietary factors. So I went back to the work by Cedric and Frank Garland. Now, these two brothers in 1980 published a seminal paper in which they said that based on the same sort of maps, that since the colon cancer rates were lowest in the south desert southwest, and they knew from their hiking experience that it was very sunny there, they hypothesized that vitamin D reduced the risk of cancer. Now, this was a revolutionary idea at that time. They had no other evidence than these maps to back this up. But they, in 1985, 1989, they found that both dietary vitamin D and the amount of vitamin D in the blood were protective against cancer, against colon cancer. So I then I saw that many of the maps look like the colon cancer map. And so in the year 2000, I posed two questions. How many cancers were vitamin D sensitive? And how many people likely died from these all types of cancer from having too little sunlight and too little vitamin D? And in year 2002, I published a paper saying there were about at least 14 types of cancer that were vitamin D sensitive. This was about 9 more than what was known at the time I published it. And, of course, was very revolutionary to the point where the American Cancer Society said, well, of course, we know that UV causes skin cancer. We're not about to say it reduces the risk of other cancers. And I was told, that was... where I got into it.
I'm going to ask you just to hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment, but the station's coming back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Dr. Grant was just commenting how he noticed the difference between the incidence of cancer in the southwest of the United States and the northeast, far more cancer in the northeast than in the southwest. And then, of course, going over the studies of other people who'd really studied this and found that there was seemed to be a definite relationship between vitamin D and cancer. And so if you had high levels of vitamin D, well, of course, you had low levels of cancer, cancer of the breast, cancer of the colon, and eventually Dr. Grant actually published a paper pointing out, there were some 14 different types of cancer that seemed to be
right.
related to vitamin D.
Right.
And, of course, the Cancer Society said, well, you know, we're against sunlight, you know, we know that certainly ultraviolet light is going to produce skin cancer. We're not going to tell people to go out in the sun in order to get their vitamin D. Everybody knows, of course, that sunlight produces cancer, and yet, of course, it's in the areas where they have lots of sun that you have a marked diminution of so many of 14 of the major cancers that are killing the American people. So what happened at that time?
Okay, so the head of epidemiology for the American Cancer Society said, well, you know, that's an interesting study, but until you put in all the other risk factors that you can model into your work, such as smoking, alcohol, diet, ethnic background, et cetera, et cetera, we can't accept this as a really good study. So these other factors are what they call confounding factors. So I dutifully went back to the drawing board. I then got all the data for the things like smoking and alcohol by state, redid the analysis, and found that there's still a very strong signal from solar ultraviolet B radiation. and sent the manuscript back to the journal Cancer. Well, they sent out for review, and the reviewers were not satisfied with the statistical work I did and rejected it. I submitted the same each time I learned from the reviewers, improved the manuscript, got it to another journal. I went through 8 other journals, and I was rejected by 9 journals from 2002 to 2006, and nobody seemed to want to publish it. And it was almost as if there was, I was on a blacklist. I mean, I don't think I was, but every time I sent it for review, it was rejected. Finally, I got it accepted as a conference proceeding paper published in a Greek journal, Anti-Cancer Research. And, well, it's already received 40 citations, which puts it in the top 1% of clinical medicine papers for the year 2006. So the science was sound, it's just that the editors and the reviewers didn't realize it was a good paper.
Well, I think, of course, it's so vitally important. People understand there is a relationship between cancer and vitamin D. And, of course, we've been in touch with other people who have done similar research. But, of course, I think yours is certainly seminal in this field. And of course, for whatever reason, here's a very, very simple, cheap way, of course, of avoiding cancer. And, of course, a lot of this could be taken care of by simply taking a vitamin D pill. Might cost you, 5 cents, 10 cents at the most a day. That's sure a lot cheaper than, of course, having to treat cancer, for $100,000, $200,000, $500,000, and then you die a slow, painful, miserable death. So why is there so much opposition to people getting vitamin D? This just doesn't make any sense. And if you don't want them to go out in the sunlight, why not just give them the vitamin pill and let them get the benefit from it?
Exactly. I think economics plays a very, very important role here. The National Cancer Institute, which funds a lot of the research on cancer in the United States, seems to have 2 goals. One is developing drugs to treat cancer, and the other now is to look at the genome and try to figure out the genetic links to cancer and how to control those. And they spend only 1 or 2% of their budget on dietary factors and the like. I think big pharma, they're pushing them to continue the drug program. I mean, if somebody gets cancer, it's a very expensive proposition for the person and for insurance company. Like you say, it turns out it's possible to get your supply of vitamin D for about $5 on the internet. And so nobody's making any money selling vitamin D. And I mean, you don't see it advertised on TV like you would quite a few other drugs. Doctors are finally becoming aware of it. We have a group, we have about 12 vitamin D experts who wrote a vitamin D researchers call for action. And had it presented to the American Medical Association about a month ago, and by golly, they passed it. They passed a resolution asking that a research a board be convened to essentially review the suggested requirements for vitamin D and the research on vitamin D and raise the recommendations.
Well, because I'm old enough to remember when, before we had antibiotics for tuberculosis, and of course, what they used to do, of course, you got tuberculosis, you're going to die usually. And then, of course, they came up with the idea of a sanitarium. And fresh air and sunlight were, of course, the treatment. As if we take the people out there, isolate them, but suddenly get them the sunlight and give them fresh air. And the people started getting well from tuberculosis. And, of course, I really believe, looking back on that, that was the vitamin D that they were getting that helps with the immune system. And certainly, doesn't vitamin D simply fortify the immune system, which, of course, is essential to avoiding cancer and also for fighting infection?
Yeah, that's my latest topic, is the boosting of the innate immune system. And what vitamin D does is first there's a whole process where you have the vitamin D like you take in a pill or make in your skin. It goes through the liver and becomes a circulating form of vitamin D we call calcidiol. And then it goes through the kidney and other organs and become the hormonal version, which we call calcitriol. It turns out that calcitriol then induces the production of what's called human cathelicidin, or for short, LL37. And it turns out that this, what's called, is now a polypeptide, is what is the active molecule from vitamin D in the innate immune system. And it has been identified by researchers at UCLA as the molecule induced by the sun that then fights a bacterial infection such as tuberculosis. Now, back about, back in 1981, there was a scientist in England who looked at the seasonality of Elmer Hope Simpson, looked at the seasonality of influenza and said it's probably related to solar UVB. But he thought it was UVB killing the virus for influenza. Well, John Cannell, a doctor down in Atascadero, thought about it some more and said, no, it's more likely that it's producing things like LL37, which is killing the virus in the body. And so we wrote a hypothesis paper. I was a co-author in that paper in 2006. And lo and behold, almost immediately, a doctor in New York, on Long Island, wrote in with a letter to the editor saying that he had actually been giving black postmenopausal women different amounts of vitamin D for a three-year period. And those who were taking a placebo had 30 cases of colds or influenza over a three-year period. Those taking 800 IU per day of vitamin D had had only 40% as much influenza or cold. And those taking 2,000 IU per day had one-tenth the risk of getting a cold or influenza. So here was experimental confirmation of a hypothesis that vitamin D produced compounds which help the innate immune system fight off the seasonal influenza and the seasonal cold.
And you know, this is something that we all know. You get your cold in the wintertime, you get your flu in the wintertime, you don't get it in the summertime. Why don't you get it in the summertime? Well, it just comes in cycles, but why does it come in the wintertime? And of course, the explanation is the vitamin D you have in the summertime helps you to ward off influenza and cold. The vitamin D you don't have in the winter because you're not getting any of the sunlight, that vitamin D deficiency then predisposes you to the influenza and colds and other illnesses we associate with winter. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, but it's a little more complicated. That's a good part of it. It turns out there are two other factors that are involved with wintertime infectious diseases. One is just being cold. It closes down the capillaries in your respiratory system. So you don't get the white blood cells to the surface of the lining where they can actually fight these viruses when they lodge on the lining. And the other thing is that some viruses live longer outside the body in low relative humidity conditions. Now, polio was the opposite. It liked a humid environment, so that was more common in summer. But influenza, respiratory syncytial virus, and cold like the low humidity and will last longer. So the three of them are involved together.
I think that's a very, very good and very valid point. And because it's not simplistic at all, but I think it's so vitally important that people understand how important vitamin D is. And simply an inexpensive pill every day, and we take it on a regular basis, and I'd say that my wife and I are really, and our son are really quite healthy, has immeasurable, health benefits. Now, do you think that it's going to be possible that organized medicine is going to begin to pick up on this? And I know, of course, when I went to medical school, we sort of poo-pooed the people, the vitamin fanatics, the health fanatics, but the longer I live, the more I think maybe they're a lot smarter than I was.
Yes, there are a lot of good signs that this is catching on. Many doctors are now requesting vitamin D tests, and so the vitamin D measuring companies are just swamped with the requests. But we also know, we've heard that the Canadian Health Ministry wants to send $1 million down to the Institute of Medicine in the United States, which is the body of the Academy of Sciences, which reviews things like dietary requirements. And we also seem to think that the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, National Institute of Medicine, are also going to be asking for such a study. So it's definitely planned for the next few months. It'll probably take about a year.
And I really think, of course, that vitamin D is also very, very important as far as osteoporosis and in the elderly. And since I'm getting to that point in life, perhaps we can talk a little bit more about that when we get back. Our guest this evening, Dr. William Grant, who's done some great work, and we'll tell you his website. You can learn as well. Well, Dr. Grant, what about the relationship between the vitamin D and osteoporosis? Certainly this is one something that really plagues so many elderly people. And, of course, they'll get, you know, osteoporosis, they'll get compression fractures of their back, and they'll be all bent over. They'll get hip fractures and wrist fractures. And what part does the vitamin D play? Or have you gone into that part of it at all?
Yeah, for osteoporosis and hip fractures and all that sort of thing, the primary benefit seems to be that vitamin D helps increase the absorption of calcium and phosphorus, perhaps some other trace minerals. And it seems to also be involved in the metabolism of vitamin D and helping getting into the bones once it's absorbed. So it's mainly seems to be helping on the calcium end of things.
And of course, I would just comment for our listeners that if you were going to be taking certainly vitamin D and calcium, you definitely want to be taking magnesium, because most people are magnesium deficient, and that balance between calcium and magnesium is very important as far as the health of the bones are concerned. Well, you know, certainly this is really sort of an exciting discovery of this, that you and a number of other people are pushing this. We've certainly know Dr. Cannell down there in Atascadero. We've talked to him on several occasions. I mean, we're only talking something that's really been more or less widely accepted for less than a decade? I'm talking really about, of course, the health benefits of vitamin D as far as cancer and the immune system.
It's been the last decade or decade and a half that it's really started, maybe mainly this decade, the last 10 years it's really started to sprout. Now, you know, in terms of what the RDA, the 200 to 400 to 700 IU per day that's recommended, that's based on just preventing rickets. Many, many studies have shown that 400 IU per day has no benefit in preventing fractures, osteoporosis, cancer, anything. It turns out that the American diet provides around 250 or 300 IU per day. That's from milk and yogurt and eggs and fish and so on. So we've been, you know, the other thing is that the health system wants to apply the same criteria for acceptance of things like vitamin D that it applies to artificial drugs. Now, in artificial drugs, you know, they have really no experience on how the body reacts to it, what the benefits are, what the risks are. But what I like to point out is that mankind has lived with vitamin D and ultraviolet radiation for ever since man was alive. And in fact, skin pigmentation is an adaptation to the amount of UV where people live. In the plains of Africa and the plains of Australia, one really should have very, very dark skin to protect against the free radical production and the folate destruction. And one will still get enough vitamin D. But as man moved out of the tropics into the higher latitudes, like towards upper parts of Europe, the skin had to lighten to allow enough UVB to penetrate deeply enough to produce the vitamin D. So, in my opinion, you use the ecological approach that I use, looking at the rates of cancer and other diseases as a function of location or season, one can really get a very, very good idea on the effect of vitamin D.
And here's one of the tragedies of today is the black population living in, of course, in the United States, specifically in the northern part of the United States, doesn't get any sun, and they don't get any vitamin D, and we'll be back here in just a moment here.
Right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. William Grant. We're talking about certainly the advantages of vitamin D. Of course, Dr. Grant was pointing out that in the tropical areas, certainly people have darker skin, and certainly the blacks in Africa have darker skin. The problem is when you take an African black and you put him in northern part of the United States, why, he's not going to get, of course, the sunlight. Of course, people with white skin can get more ultraviolet and certainly can get the benefits of sunlight on their skin. And our skin actually manufactures the vitamin D very well, but the blacks have very, very problems because they really need to have supplements, don't they?
Yes, they do. They do.
How much vitamin D should people take? Because this is really a big thing. I mean, the government does, 200 units, something like that, or 400 units?
400, 700, depending on age.
Right. But, of course, what should people really be taking?
Well, according to Robert Heaney in Nebraska, who studied calcium and vitamin D for decades, the body can use about 3,600 IU per day. And now they did a study. They did a study on postmenopausal women and vitamin D and turns out in cancer. And they found that women had an average of 30 nanograms per milliliter, which is, say, about the population average. That's, in other words, if you just go about your business during the day, go out for a few minutes, you might have 30 nanograms. They found by adding about 10 nanograms, adding 1,000 IU per day or 10 nanograms to the blood, they actually reduced cancer incidence rates by 35%. So that was boosting up to around 40 nanograms. What we're saying is that the healthy level is somewhere around 40, 50, 60 nanograms, or about 100 nanomoles per milliliter. And that would take anywhere from 1 to 4,000 IU per day to achieve that. And it turns out that if a person has 100% of the body exposed to UV, one can make about 10,000 IU per day. So what this is saying is that's the physiological dose of vitamin D, so the body has to be able to handle that without getting any adverse effects. In fact, it turns out that the adverse effects seem to start at more like 40,000 IU per day. So what I'm trying to say is that a reasonable amount for people to take is anywhere from maybe 1,000 to 4,000 to 5,000 IU per day, and you don't really have to worry about the adverse effects unless you have maybe Hodgkin's lymphoma, or if you have Meyer's lung, sarcoidosis, things like that. It's really a very safe compound.
And because my family uses vitamin D when we're starting to come down with a cold or with during the flu season, and taking some herb of something that contains various herbs and vitamin D, whatever you can use to ward those things off, you could almost feel the infection waning when you begin to take the disease, and then a few hours later comes back again, and you take the pills again, and suddenly do you have anybody suggesting that vitamin D be used to ward off influenza and colds during the wintertime?
Well, I've just heard that there's a study will be conducted in the Netherlands on vitamin D for preventing influenza this coming year. And what John Cannell likes to say is that Linus Pauling was certainly on the right track with vitamin C, but he was off by one letter.
In other words, it should have been not C, but D.
Right.
Well, maybe if you take actually both of them, but we're pretty increasingly emphasizing the value of vitamin D. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question for Dr. Grant, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But I really think this is such a vitally important issue because certainly some of the studies have shown at least a 40% decrease in cancer. Is that a fairly accurate figure for people taking vitamin D?
Well, we're saying at least 30%.
Okay. And cancer is really so devastating. I mean, after all, if you can cut your incidence of cancer, 30% for $5 or so a year, why, wouldn't it be worthwhile doing it?
Right.
And really, of course, these are things that are not widely known. Occasionally, you'll see an article in the newspaper about it. I don't know whether it's in the medical journals. I don't have time to read them now, but certainly if some of the material we're getting on the email is certainly verified everything that Dr. Grant is saying. People must understand that there's some very, very simple solutions. Of course, you can wait until you get the cancer and then spend a couple of $100,000 on cancer treatment. Or wouldn't it be much easier simply to take a vitamin D a day? And I think there are other things that you should take along with that will actually help to markedly decrease the incidence of cancer. But this is not being talked about. I go to the medical meetings at the hospital regularly. We never hear it talked about there. We hear about all the fancy new forms of surgery and radiation and chemotherapy, but something as simply as simple as vitamin D, hardly any doctor is really aware of this. And that's why you need to know and teach them. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is William Grant, and of course, he's been studying this for some time. Are you doing this really more or less on your own? Are you doing this with grants? Are you affiliated with any academic institution, or is this something that's just on your heart to try to help?
Well, I retired from NASA in 2002, took an early retirement because I found health research much more interesting than atmospheric sciences. I used to get to fly around the world, go into the South Pacific and all the islands on numerous field missions. But when Bush became president, those trips sort of ceased, and so it wasn't quite as much fun. So I have retirement income. I also do get a modest amount of funding from ultraviolet foundations associated with indoor tanning in the United States, Canada, and Europe. But I just have a real passion for this. I find that I have a unique set of skills to bring to this. I have plenty of time. I spend most of it doing this research. I'm not a medical doctor, so I don't deal with people. I just deal with data and literature. I write reviews. I do process data and go to conferences. I've got 6 conferences this year. So I do collaborate with a number of people. I'm collaborating with the Garlands, who originally found the vitamin D cancer connection. We're writing a whole series of papers. I'm collaborating. I've got a collaboration going now with the German group of vitamin D experts. One thing I'm doing now that should be of interest to your readers, listeners, is I'm assessing the reduction in economic burden of disease if everybody took 1,000 or 2,000 IU of vitamin D per day for a particular country. And for the United States, what I found, for the United States, there's effects for cancer, respiratory diseases, heart disease and stroke, autoimmune diseases, of course, fractures, and I'm even now working on Alzheimer's disease. And what I found is that if we take that all together, and look at both the direct and indirect costs. And the direct costs are usually about 1/3 of the total cost of disease. You've got the time loss from work. You've got the care from your family and friends. And you have reduced life expectancy. So if you take that all together, I find that the economic burden of low vitamin D in the United States is about $200 billion a year. And I also find there are about 300,000 excess deaths per year from the cancers, the heart diseases, the diabetes, and so on. And what this corresponds to is...
Oh, hold that thought for there for just a moment. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. William Grant. And before we go on, Dr. Grant, I'd like you to go ahead and get your website out there. And okay. If you have a telephone number, any periodicals, or anything you'd like to suggest for our listeners, go ahead. This is the time.
Okay, my main contact is through my website, which is www.sunarc.org. That's sun, S-U-N, like sun in the sky, A-R-C, so sunarc.org. And then I have other contact information there, like my email address and postal address and that sort of thing. And one thing that I want to point out to people there is I have a vitamin D starter kit. It's a list of the important websites, the important papers, the where to get vitamin D. It's about a 12-page document that can be downloaded, and you can use that to familiarize yourself with the whole vitamin D story.
In fact, I got that. I appreciate you sending it to me, and it looks fascinating. And, of course, this is going to go in my vitamin D file. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. That's 464-8295. But you were mentioning heart disease. Now, we don't really associate heart disease with vitamin D. Is there a definite relationship?
Yes, there is. Unfortunately, I could not determine that with my ecological approach. In other words, there's not enough geographical variation. Because heart disease and stroke are strongly linked to diet, to smoking, to bad lifestyle, alcohol consumption, etc. But studies from Harvard, from Austria, and from the Framingham study this year have reported that those with serum calcidiol levels greater than 30 nanograms per milliliter have about half the risk of either developing or dying from stroke and coronary heart disease than those who have less than 10 nanograms per milliliter. Now, you ask, well, what are the mechanisms likely to be? Well, I can name three possible mechanisms. One is that, of course, vitamin D increases the absorption of calcium, and it appears that calcium reduces the risk of stroke and possibly coronary heart disease. The second is that vitamin D, through the production of LL37, reduces the risk of infectious disease. So often heart disease is related to some infection, and it could just be an adverse reaction to the infection. It could have, maybe you know better than I, how an infection leads to heart attack. And the third thing is that vitamin D improves insulin sensitivity, so it reduces risk of diabetes. And diabetes is an important risk factor for coronary heart disease. And I'm sure if we look at it in more detail, we'll find more mechanisms to be able to show that those really are involved.
And, of course, vitamin D is really just essential for health. And, of course, certainly warding off osteoporotic fractures or fractures from osteomalacia being a shortage of bone, and the primary shortage of calcium in the bone, whereas osteoporosis is shortage of protein in the bone. But they both manifest with the same problems as far as ready fractures, and they look very, very similar on x-ray demineralization of the bone. So, but here is such a simple method of doing it, and vitamin D is really, you get it. Now, are there specific types of vitamin D? We hear it, vitamin D3 to vitamin D4. What type of vitamin D should be taking?
Okay, the primary vitamin D, the one we make in our bodies, is vitamin D3, also called cholecalciferol. The primary source of that in supplements is from lanolin from sheep's wool that's been irradiated with UVB. It can also be found in fish oil, cod liver oil, but one problem with taking cod liver oil is that often the manufacturers put too much vitamin A with the vitamin D, and since the vitamin A and vitamin D receptors are similar, the vitamin A can take the place of vitamin D, and then that can impede the absorption of calcium, and studies in both Harvard and in Sweden have found that greater than 1,500 IU of vitamin A per day actually increases the risk of hip fractures. Now, the other source of vitamin D is from vegetables, either mushrooms or from irradiated yeast, irradiated mushrooms for that matter, too. And that's called vitamin D2 or ergocalciferol. It seems to raise circulating vitamin D levels or calcidiol levels about the same as vitamin D3 does, but there a number of studies have reported that the D2 is less effective in fighting disease than the D3. So we recommend, I tend to recommend the D3.
And I will echo that, because I sometimes I ask questions when I know the answer. D3 is what people should be taking. Don't be, make sure that's what you're getting. Well, our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We got Maria. Maria, I guess, calling from Michigan. Hi, where are you calling from in Michigan, Marie?
This is Mario.
Oh, Mario, okay.
Yeah, my question for Dr. Grant, you're speaking about vitamin D. It seems like primarily in terms of supplements, but wouldn't it be at least just as important to try to eat the foods where it naturally occurs? And one of the things that Dr. Stan often talks about is how the natural nutrients in the food supply have largely been depleted because of the industrialization of the food market. And wouldn't it be better, or wouldn't it be important to try to buy food from an organically grown farm,
right,
or from a farmer's market?
All right, fine. Let's get the Dr. Grant's response to that. What are your thoughts on that, Sydney?
Okay. Well, most of the vitamin D we obtain from food in the United States is from fortified milk and yogurt and orange juice and things like that. And people living north of the Arctic Circle historically got their vitamin D from both fish and sea mammals. That's the only way they could survive because in higher latitudes, there are about 6 months of the year when there's not enough solar ultraviolet D radiation to manufacture any vitamin D. Now, animals, egg yolks have some vitamin D, meat may have a little vitamin D, but the average American gets around 250 or 300 international units of vitamin D from food per day. And as I pointed out earlier, that's really insufficient to have any really health benefit other than preventing rickets. So it turns out that 90% of Americans get most of the vitamin D from solar ultraviolet D radiation. So if we're talking about a natural source, it's really the sun. Now, of course, when we're talking about 2,000 or 4,000 IU per day, that means really going out and spending maybe half an hour with half your body exposed. And in our modern lifestyle, we really don't have time for that. And, of course, there are the associated problems of risk of skin cancer. So, unfortunately, just going organic, you're not going to get vitamin D from vegetables. You've got to get it from animal products. And it turns out if you eat fish, which is our biggest source of vitamin D, first of all, we're depleting the ocean stock of fish. And secondly, fish tend to accumulate organophosphates or anyway, chemicals that are pesticides and like, as well as mercury.
Right. So I really think, of course, the sun, this is called the sunshine vitamin, and certainly there in Michigan, which is pretty far north, why, of course, you really, of course, not going to get that amount of sun. And the vitamin D capsules really are very inexpensive, and you really ought to be taking them. And you're really talking about a couple of thousand micrograms or whatever it is, I guess, international units, aren't they, Doctor?
Right.
International units. This is the basic source. You're not going to get enough of it from eating right now. You should be eating right. You should be eating organic. You should be certainly, getting the diet, but not for vitamin D. That's for all the other things that you need. Okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
God bless. And thanks for calling. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. And we've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Sam. I have a question for your guest.
Right.
The irradiated mushrooms got my attention. How does that work?
Well, they, in the skin, there's a form of cholesterol that goes to vitamin D. And so the best I can tell is that mushrooms have a cholesterol-like compound that when sunlight hits it can modify it just enough so it can become similar to the vitamin D in the body.
And there's something called ergosterol, I think it is. Of course, remember, I'm looking back 50 years ago to my days of biochemistry, but ergosterol was a prologue to vitamin D. Is that right?
Well, it's an analog.
It's an analog, right. Okay.
Well, something might have gone by me. What does the irradiation have to do with it?
Well, it somehow changes it. I forget what it adds to it chemically. Just like in the body, it's a several-step process. You first have UV modifying it slightly, then you have to have heat in the body to convert to the next step, and then that goes to the liver and through the kidneys. So, unfortunately, I'm a physicist, not a chemist, and I can't tell you more right now.
But that's really how it works. And certainly, likewise, we can get some more books out there, Mike. And but certainly, it's a complicated chemical process. But it's amazing that the sun will, of course, cause the fatty tissue in our subcutaneous tissue to produce vitamin D, and then, of course, apparently the radiation of the mushrooms will help. It's just another source of the same thing. But the most important thing is we were getting the sunshine, but how do you get the time to get out? I know I don't get out there, but my wife dutifully gives me the vitamin D every day, and as you know, I'm fairly healthy. So anything else, Mike?
Good enough for now. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much. That was Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY.
I can do another thing now if you've got a minute.
You go right ahead.
One of the things I'm examining now is periodontal disease. Turns out when I lived in Berlin for 2 years, where there's very little sun, then came back to California, I had very severe periodontal disease. Well, it turns out that vitamin D helps fight periodontal disease and caries, dental caries, because both periodontal disease and caries are linked to bacteria. And so this LL37 produced from vitamin D gets into the mouth and actually helps kill these bacteria. And you probably from your practice know that there are many diseases linked to periodontal disease, heart disease, stroke, some forms of cancer, lung cancer, et cetera. And I think the reason they're all linked is that vitamin D is actually fighting each of these diseases separately. So if you have periodontal disease, that's a good indication that you're vitamin D deficient.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Karen is calling us from, I guess, is that Sacramento, Karen?
Sacramento, doctor.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, thank you. If you're taking the vitamin D every day, and I also take a multivitamin twice a day, and CoQ10 and that sort of thing, but I heard, Dr. Stan, you say something about combining it with magnesium, or maybe I didn't catch it, but
yes.
Can you just take the vitamin D3 along with maybe multiple vitamins, or do you need to combine it so that it absorbs properly?
Well, I think that, of course, basically, do you have any comments on that, Dr. Grant?
No, not really. No.
All right, fine. Well, basically, most people in America are magnesium deficient. We have a wonderful book on the miracle of magnesium, and certainly magnesium is something you really need, and you need the magnesium to balance the calcium. Now, most people do not need to take supplementary calcium. One of the big problems we have is we're getting too much calcium, and a lot of the hardening of the arteries is related to the calcium there, and right now, of course, increasingly they're doing scans to see if you have calcium in your arteries, and if you don't have any calcium in your arteries, you're not going to probably drop over dead from a heart attack, but you may very well drop over from magnesium deficiency, because if you don't get enough magnesium, you'll get cardiac irregularity. Magnesium slows down the heart, so magnesium is really very important, and I will tell you that I take it every evening before I go to bed, and as you know, I've had heart surgery, I had auricular fibrillation. I'm really doing fairly well at the present time, but I take my magnesium dutifully every day. And I don't take supplementary calcium. I drink a little milk. I shouldn't, but I drink a little milk and have cottage cheese, and I'm getting my calcium that way. Does that help you, Karen?
Yes.
The other thing is that selenium is important, too. Not too much, but people...
I'm taking 200 a day of the selenium.
Fine. That's great. Be careful you don't have a lot of selenium in your multivitamin. Sometimes they'll sneak it in there. You don't want to go much over 200 a day.
Okay.
Okay?
Is there a recommendation on magnesium, please?
It's late at night, but I think it's... if you want to give me a call in the morning, I'll have the figures for you. Okay?
You've been very kind. Thank you, Dr.
God bless.
Stan.
Bye-bye. And right now we've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, is this the same Mike or a different Mike?
Different Mike.
Okay, Mike, good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks. I just tuned in. I was curious as to, I'm not real clear as far as the IUs. It says 400 IUs or milligrams. What is it?
It's international units.
International units.
Right.
Okay, so that's like 400 milligrams, or
no, go ahead, Dr. Grant. You're probably better.
I think it's about 40 IU for microgram or something. I forget the conversion.
So what would you say?
Five micrograms is 200 or 400 IU. So one microgram is something like 40 or 50 international units.
Better to stick with the international units, otherwise you're going to get really confused.
Yeah, so how many of these a day would you recommend?
Well, basically we're talking about international units, at least 1,000, 2,000, you can go up to 5,000.
Really? So
there's some people, when I get a cold, I've taken the 5,000 units, every time I turn around. When I was practicing medicine, I used to use 50,000 units of vitamin D twice a week for in treatment of osteoporosis. Of course, I was also using fluoride. I look back and think, how could I have been so stupid? But the head came out of the Mayo Clinic. I hope I did not harm any of my patients, because I couldn't get the amount that they were using in the Mayo Clinic. So I gave them just a very homeopathic dose. I don't think I hurt anybody. But the 50,000 units twice a day is fine. You just don't want to take it every day. But if you stay within 4,000 or 5,000 international units a day, you're not going to get into trouble.
Okay, and one last question. Is D3, I mean, is that the one that you're talking about?
Right, right.
Okay, it is. Great. Well, keep up the good work. I appreciate it.
God bless, and thanks so very much. And again, our telephone number, well, we're just about out of time here for that matter. I guess this evening has been William Grant. And let me suggest you go to his website at www.sunarc.org. The sunarc.org. It's a great website, and not only that, it has a lot of links to other websites. And so you can get everything you ever wanted to know about vitamin D and everything you're ever going to need to know about vitamin D there. But the one thing is, we're not getting the sunlight. We're not taking off our shirts and going out for half an hour a day. And if you don't do it, you need to be taking a supplement. But would that be a fair statement, Dr. Grant?
Right. Yes, indeed.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, we're going to be doing some other programs on vitamin D. We've had Dr. Cannell on from the Tascadero. We've probably put together a tape set on vitamin D. We think this is very important. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Dr. Grant, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up this evening's program for your thoughts.
Well, let's see what I can say. In my opinion, and I've been working on health issues about 12 years now, looking at both dietary factors and ultravitamin D and vitamin D. In my opinion, vitamin D, taking adequate amount of vitamin D, which is 1,000 to 4,000 to 5,000 international units per day, is the most cost-effective, simplest thing to do to improve one's health. It can reduce the risk of cancer. It's also very, very beneficial in the latter stage of cancer. For example, they find in Norway that people diagnosed with cancer summer or fall have a better survival rate than people diagnosed in winter or spring. So, it fights cancer, it fights infectious diseases, especially in winter. It fights autoimmune disease. Even if you have multiple sclerosis, it can still reduce the symptoms. It seems to reduce the risk of heart disease and stroke, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, periodontal disease, dental caries. What was pointed out by some people is that Michael Hollick, who's Mr. Vitamin D at Boston University, points out that every cell in the body can recognize vitamin D. A study out of Oakland, Bruce Ames and Joyce McCann, show that there is very, very good reason to believe that vitamin D has an important role to play in the brain. There's other studies showing that muscle pain, non-specific muscle pain in the back, is linked to low vitamin D. So it's $5 a year from the internet. You really can't go wrong with adding a regular dose of vitamin D to your daily regimen. Vitamin D lasts about, the half-life of vitamin D in the body is 4 to 6 weeks, which means you can skip a day or two and make up for it. But really, vitamin D is, if you don't want to change your lifestyle, if you don't want to change your diet, and so on, it's sort of like buying insurance, propping yourself up, helping to extend your healthy life expectancy by a year or two, and fight off all these nasty diseases.
Well, I really appreciate what you're doing. You know, I've learned a lot more about nutrition since I left organized medicine. I didn't have the time to be reading all of these things. I've had the opportunity to talk to people such as yourself and other people who are doing research in these subjects. The scientific literature is all there. It's simply that we're not going to have the opportunity to get that. So, Dr. Grant, I really appreciate so much your being with us this evening. It's getting a little bit late, but thank you so much, and I hope maybe we can get you onto some of our other programs. As you know, we do 5 hours of talk radio a day, and we have 4 different audiences every week. But good night, and God bless you. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I do hope you enjoyed our program with Dr. Grant, and certainly if you'd like to get the tape or the CD of it, we do talk during the breaks. They're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. I really would want to put together a four-tape set or four-CD set on this, and we just need to get one or two more speakers on this, but I think Dr. Grant is absolutely right. And certainly, for those of you who don't know, we of Radio Liberty does carry some of these products. We have a health catalog. We'd be glad to send it to you. If you just call us at 1-800-544-8927. Why do we carry the medical supplies? Well, basically because these are the things that Barbara and I take, or most of the things that we take, and the things that are recommended by our good friends like Dr. Russell Blaylock and Bill Sardi and others who have studied these things extensively. Now, if you certainly would like to get the Dr. Russell Blaylock's book, which is sort of like the Bible that we carry talking about these things, the telephone number, the title is Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. And if you'd like to get the book, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Russell's written another excellent book, and that's Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients. If you've got cancer, somebody in your family has cancer, and they're going to give them chemotherapy and all these things, and they're going to go through with the traditional therapy, you need nutritional supplements. Otherwise, your hair is going to fall out. You're going to become violently ill. But it's amazing. I've talked to people who actually used the supplements when they went through chemotherapy, and the doctor couldn't figure out why their hair didn't fall out, why they didn't get deathly ill with the diarrhea like everybody else. Nobody's going to give you any guarantees, but I believe with all my heart of hearts that nutritional supplements are important. So we carry both of those books we mentioned. We do carry, of course, we take vitamin D, we take selenium, we take the magnesium. We take quite a few pills every day, but I tell you what, I look and see some of my contemporaries who practice medicine when I did, and I see them all bent over and sort of shuffling around, and I'm doing pretty well, all in all. Why really believe it's what we're taking in and the supplements we're using? Under any circumstances, if you'd like to get our health catalog, we'd be glad to send it to you. And, of course, if you'd like to get, of course, our regular catalog, you can get that, or you can get our emergency food catalog. We have them all available simply by calling 1-800-544-8927. Actually, of course, we have the health and the regular catalog on a CD-ROM. We'd be glad to send you free of charge. If you want a printed catalog, you're going to have to request it. Otherwise, you get the CD-ROM. But if you have a computer, they've done a beautiful job of putting this all there on the CD-ROM, and you can go down and see all the various things we're talking about and the other things we have. The Berkey water filters, if you don't have a water filter, you need to have a water filter in case we get into an emergency situation so that you can purify any sort of water. And certainly the Big Berkey or the Berkey Light, I mean, the Big Berkey's been used overseas, by missionaries for 150 years. And we recommend them. Can't get them here in California. You can get the Berkey Light, however, for travel. And so we do hope, if you're interested in any of these things, why our website is radioliberty.com. If you'd like the free catalogs, and you specify what you want, printed or CD-ROM, and of course if you want the health, if you want the general catalog, if you want the emergency food, again, our number 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Dr. Grant was talking about how he had so much difficulty getting his paper published that showed the relationship between cancer. What you really need to do is get our four-tape set. It's called The New Order of the Barbarians. It's based upon a talk that was given back in 1969 by Dr. Richard Day, who was, of course, the former medical consultant for Planned Parenthood, and he spoke quite openly about the fact that there are too many people in the world. They're going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. They were going to suppress cancer treatments. And ladies and gentlemen, they're doing it today. If you have never read the Fitzgerald Report, go up to our website, and it's listed there as one of our newsletters, or give us a call. We'll be glad to send you one. And then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.